Good evening. I'm Nancy Nangeroni.
I'm Gordine McKenzie.
And this is Gender Talk. Hello again, this is Gender Talk Worldwide Radio that talks about transgenderism in the first person. Each week we bring you news, information, and exciting new voices that challenge our traditional view of gender and more. Tonight we're going to talk about transgender relationship issues, this time with a couple who split up when he decided to transition to living as a woman. They've since reunited while she is still adjusting to her new identity. We'll find out what issues they overcame to get back together and what they see looming ahead. Then we're going to look at how gender plays out in the scenarios that create and wage war with the man who identifies as a different kind of transgender, Professor Mark Bonagura. And as long as we're creating without waging, we'll also have the Twisted Nasty News Question of the Week and much more tonight on Gender Talk.
We have a guest returning tonight. We have Mark Bonagura. And Mark is a professor of English at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. And he's conducted hundreds of hours of interviews with World War II veterans, specifically U.S. Marines, of the campaign for the Guadalcanal. He's compiled a website on his work, and he's in the process of writing a biography of a World War II Marine named Bob Worthington. And Mark's own father, Michael Bonagura, was a Marine raider who also fought in the Guadalcanal. And Mark, thank you for coming back to Gender Talk.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here again.
Yeah, it's our pleasure to have you back.
Now, Mark, in your research, a large focus that you've been working on is war and gender. And we talked to you last time about your own feelings around gender, your own gender identity, and some of your gender story. Tell us some of the things that you've been finding out from the interviews that you've been doing.
Well, I think that the issue of war and gender is probably one of the more important things that everybody should be talking about these days.
Ooh, yeah.
because it was a little striking to me. I was surprised. I did a little bit of preliminary research just to kind of help frame the talk a little bit tonight, because some statistics that I wasn't totally aware of. But I found that even today, 97% of the world's standing armies are male, and of the combat-ready forces, 99.9% are males.
Mm.
And this is after, you know, a couple of decades where many countries, you know, America included, have been bringing women into the military.
That's right.
And making, you know, great efforts to do that. But still, with all that, the people who generally are in the front lines and who are involved in the most, you know, when you think of a war, you know, that's what you think of, have almost always been male.
It's a guy game, isn't it?
It's a guy game. It's something that men plan and men fight, and men either profit by it or, well, everybody suffers from it, I think.
And they watch it. They watch war movies and stuff too, huh?
Well, yeah, there's such... there's such a, I would almost call it a lie that's sort of built around war. And when you talk about what I learned from my interviews, is that so few of the veterans who've been in the front lines have ever really spoken about their experience.
Oh.
And to me, that's the most amazing thing, that they could go through such terrible things and have to do such terrible things to survive.
And not talk about it.
And not talk about it for 40, 50 years afterwards.
That's shocking.
I would do interviews, and usually the person's spouse would come to me afterwards, and she would say, I can't believe my husband said all that. He hasn't talked about the war for 50 years. And what happens when they start to talk about it, I mean, I'm kind of all about, I have hope, I guess, or I want hope for the world, and I would like to live someday in a world, or at least in a country, that didn't look to war as the first means of solving a conflict. You know, I would love to see war outlawed because I think it's such a costly thing.
And, yes.
But what the spouses tell me, you know, that you know, they never talked about it, and this is part of the conspiracy, because I think if all the veterans were ever to get together and sit down in a room and actually, you know, speak the truth of their experiences, I think we would move, you know, a little bit closer to realizing what war really is, because we as a society, we always seem to go the other way. We have, you know, so many images in the media, video games and movies and just a lot of really unrealistic things that people think, well, this is what war is. And, you know, Americans have been very lucky over the years that most of the war has never happened, you know, on our soil.
That's
so
right.
We don't know what it's really about, but the thing that's really bad is that we perpetuate this image, and you know, it just keeps getting passed down from generation to generation, and I think that at some point we really have to stop that, and you know, we've got to listen to what the veterans say, and we've got to start with our children, the way we raise them, especially the boys.
You know, did they tell their wives about their experiences?
No.
And you talked to?
For the most part, no, they didn't tell anyone.
Oh.
And in people who are in the Guadalcanal campaign, people like my dad and Bob Worthington, a lot of those guys, when they did start to talk when they first came back, some of them were put in psychiatric wards and hospitals because what they were saying was so unbelievable that the people back at home, the doctors even, who were supposed to be, you know, helping them, couldn't deal with it. I mean, I have accounts of Navy chaplain who talks about the Guadalcanal veterans who were in psychological wards.
Mark, can you tell us any of those stories? Can you relate some of this?
Yeah, you know, it was, Guadalcanal was a really unusual engagement. It was the first ground battle against the Japanese in World War II, and it took place, from August 7th, 1942 till December 9th. So it was relatively long in terms of a campaign, and it was this isolated island in the southwestern Pacific. You know, most Americans had never heard of it. And they wouldn't have thought about it, but the Japanese were starting to build a base there. They were starting to build an airstrip where they could land planes, and hopefully they would then be able to launch attacks on Australia and New Zealand, because by that time the Japanese Empire had really spanned most of the Pacific, and they had an incredible amount of area that they controlled, but they didn't control Australia or New Zealand, and that's what they were hoping to do from Guadalcanal. They could have an airstrip where they could launch their planes, and hopefully they would be able to take over Australia. So it was very strategically important, but as I said, most Americans had never heard of it. And the kind of people who fought, the Marines who fought in Guadalcanal were very young. Most of them went in when they were 17 years of age, and so by the time the campaign came up, they were 18, 19, and they were going against the most seasoned Japanese troops. These were the best troops that the Japanese Empire had, and it was a terribly brutal and almost like a war of attrition, because our troops were there and they were sort of stuck there without supplies, and they had very little ammunition, very little food, and so it was almost like they were thrown into this place of torture where they had to survive. They had to stay alive each day, and that was their only victory. In other words, they never even thought there was a time when they didn't think they were going to win. The people in the Navy and the people who were, you know, who were orchestrating the war were basically ready to write it off and saying, well, we were going to lose this battle because it's hopeless. So they were in this psychological, I can't even describe what it must have been like for them, literally, you know.
Well, it sounds pretty desperate and terrifying.
Yeah.
It really is. And the Japanese, they wound up landing somewhere around 40,000 troops, and of those 40,000, 30,000 were killed in the battles.
Oh. Wow.
And for the Americans, we started off with about 18,000, and we lost about 7,000, and quite a bit more were wounded. Mm. So it was really just a brutal, terrible, you know, when you think of a war, you know, that's what you think of. But, you know, amazingly or miraculously, a lot of things happened that we were able to win. We were able to win the battle, and when it was over, now this is World War II, so of course there's no, you know, there's no press coverage, there's no kind of reports from the battle, but the reports started to come in after it was pretty sure that we were going to win the battle. After December 9th, the New York Times would have articles and reports. And right away, this is what I really found out, and this is what rings true from the men who spoke to me, that right away the story was spun, and they actually used Guadalcanal, if you can imagine that, as a recruitment thing to get people to join the Marines, saying, you know, this we had this amazing victory, and there were articles in the New York Times that said, you know, things like, the Marines didn't want to leave the island, but, you know, they had to be relieved, and they were, you know, they were like gritting their teeth, and it was just, the language that they used was just unbelievable to describe it, you know, which brings home the fact that unfortunately really hasn't changed to this day, even with our current situation in Iraq, is the reality of war is never brought home to the people who, you know.
It's always spun by a propaganda machine which acts in service of winning the war at all cost.
Or creating it.
Well, and allowing it to continue.
Yep.
Because,
yeah.
You know, like I said, I think, and these veterans, when they came home, a lot of them had post-traumatic stress disorder. Almost all of them had caught malaria on the island. So they were very sick, and they were trying to just heal themselves and get on with their lives, you know. But many of them went years and years and years, decades, without speaking to anyone about it.
Mark, let's talk about, now, what is the role of gender in all this?
Well, I think what happens is, and there's been a lot of books lately that I think are really good and written on this subject. One of them was called Real Boys. It was written by William Pollack. It came out a couple years ago. But it, basically, the way we raise boys and the way we indoctrinate teenagers to become soldiers, you know, is really the issue. You know, war, despite the fact that it's very prevalent all throughout human history, you know, there's been war pretty much, but it's still an unnatural act. You know, to kill another human being in any situation is not something that we don't, you know, most of us, the overwhelming majority, we don't grow up and think that's what I want to do. So you've got to teach someone to do that. You've got to really make them, you know, some of my Marines told me it was akin to brainwashing, you know. You had to, like, turn someone into a soldier. But the thing is that a lot of the ways that I think we raise little boys, or we start that process, you know. We start it when they're very young. And that's a thing that Pollack talked about in his book, that we take these little two-year-olds and we start to teach them the rules of the boy code, as he calls it, the rules to becoming a boy. You know, you suppress your feelings, you don't cry, you're always tough, you know. And these, they may sound, you know, somewhat inconsequential for a young two-year-old, but this is what gets magnified throughout your whole life.
Now, this ties into to politics, as Noam Chomsky described in his book Rogue States, The Role of Force in World Affairs. We still live in a world where international disputes are settled with armies and with killing. And is there a role that gender plays in that, you think, and is there a way out of that, or does gender and does looking at gender provide us with a path or a means?
Is some of that, Mark, I'm wondering, when I'm listening to what you're saying, Is it that conquering, the way that we raise young boys to suppress their feelings and to be competitive and to go out and to conquer, is that something that's capitalized on?
I think so, and I think it's also it's a culture of violence.
Good point.
Saying that violence is okay, that, well, at least if you're a boy, you know, it's okay to use that power over someone else, if you want something or if you've been wronged or something like that. And I think that just translates right up to the top, that we, you know, with the situation that we have still in Iraq,
sure.
You know, there were so many people who were calling all over the world, millions of people were saying, please, let's have a diplomatic solution, let's wait, let's explore all the options. And our response was basically, you know, from our president was like, well, you know what? We know we're the greatest military power in the world, and we can basically do whatever we want, so we're going to do it.
It's like
you
the biggest bully on the block, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, it's just the fact that, you know, just because you have that force, you don't, you know, using it is a whole different matter. Okay. But I think that again, I think that boys are often not raised to be whole human beings. And I think if you're not a whole human being, or at least you feel like that, you know, you're subject to, you could be brainwashed very easily. You know, you could be, you don't have a solid foundation. You don't know who you are. And so then you need somebody to tell you who you are. You don't know how many people teenagers and people that I've taught, they go into the military because they'll say, I don't know who I am. You know, I need a sense of direction. And so I think that boys are really, they're really vulnerable in that way. And you know, as I said, this gets passed from generation to generation, and that's something that I really can't understand. I can't understand how someone could go through this and then not want something better.
And want their own son, for example, to go through this. Now, how does this affect, like, gender relations between women and men? If you have men that have had experiences like this, taking masculinity and maxing it out to its far extreme, then you bring them back and you expect them to be partnered with women, if they're heterosexual. What happens in those relationships?
Yeah, it's very, it can be very difficult, because if you like Bob Worthington, the guy I wrote about, you know, he would tell me again and again and again, you know, I went through this war and I basically had to suppress all my human emotions. I had to get rid of all my feelings, and the only thing I could feel was hatred and anger. That's the only thing that was going to sustain me, were those emotions. Now, how do you come back and try to have, you know, a marriage or a relationship? You know, how are you going to do that when those are the only things you know to rely on?
That's right.
And I think, honestly, I think that the men that I talked to who had survived, you know, who lived into their 70s and 80s and are still alive today, most of the ones who survived had partners, had women who were with them all this time. And they'll be the first ones to tell you that if it wasn't for their women, for their wives, they wouldn't be here today, because they were the real healers, you know. They were the ones who had to, you know, had to take that energy and somehow help them get through it.
So when we choose, as Bush did, a military solution to a diplomatic problem, what we're doing is we're condemning a whole generation of mostly men to be tortured and to be left afterwards to the mercy of the winds of whatever happens to them.
I think so, and I think that, as again, you know, it wasn't just in World War II where we sort of have this media blackout. You know, today, for years and years and years, when soldiers would die overseas, they would come back to Dover Air Force Base, and there would be some type of a TV camera there. There would be a little, almost an informal public ceremony, where this was like news, you know. And now, for this recent war, the Bush administration won't allow that. They won't allow any cameras at Dover Air Force Base. So that we've compartmentalized this whole aspect of war, and we don't even hear about it. We don't hear about, people may know that 500 or something, you know, American casualties, but they don't talk about the people who are wounded. And they don't bring this home, and that was what burned in a lot of these veterans. It burned in their hearts that they said that somehow the truth of this has to come out, that people have to know what it really means. It's not, you know, it's not like a bad John Wayne movie or a video game or something like that.
The romanticized war movie.
It does irreparable harm, in other words.
You know, it does, and you know, these movies they make, most of the war movies you see today, the producers go to the Pentagon and they say, you know, approve the script, and then in return they get to use the toys, you know, they get to use the machines of the military.
Sure, because they're making propaganda. Mark, we're pretty much out of time. Gordine has another comment she wants to make.
I was just thinking, my dad was a First World War pilot, and I just remember he did tell his story. His best friend, Harry Brokaw, was killed in First World War, and he used to take the picture out, and he used to show me and Harry's last letter, and he would cry. And that's the only time I ever saw my dad cry, and I was deeply moved by
that.
Wow.
And I'd like to make a quick comment. There's a show that Gwen Dyer did on PBS several years ago called War, A Commentary. If you can get your hands on it at a video store or a library, check it out. It addresses a lot of these issues.
I just want to add something real quick. One of the best people, a physician from the Veterans Administration, who told me he had a lot of success with dealing with people with post-traumatic stress, and he said, you know, the number one thing that we can do is to listen without judgment and to encourage people to tell their stories, and that's where we can start to promote healing. That's the only way we can go. We have to have the truth. We have to have people telling their stories, and that's what I hope I'm doing in my book that I'm writing. I really hope that I'm doing that.
All right, and people can find out more about what you're doing at www.thetigerisdead.com, or they can send you can send an email to Mark Bonagura at mbonagura@brookdale.edu. Mark, thank you so much for being our guest on Gender Talk. I'm sorry we have to rush off, but we do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the work you're doing, Mark.